Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology or personalities in political life. The influence of culture on politics, on a nation, its people, but also on its policies and its relations with other countries is profound. And one situation which perhaps illustrates this very clearly is the current debate about whether or not to return the Parthenon sculptures, that are also known as the Elgin marbles, to Greece. To help me draw back the curtain on this story and to look at culture in politics more widely, I am delighted to be joined by Lord Vasey of Didcot. Lord Vasey is a political commentator and politician, and he was Minister for Culture, Communications and Creative Industries from 2010 to 2016. Hello, Ed.
Hello.
Great to have you on my couch, as they say. Tell us about the Parthenon sculptures. Tell us what they are and what the current situation is about possibly handing them back to Greece.
So the Parthenon sculptures are a frieze that adorned the Acropolis, the Parthenon, rather, on the Acropolis in Athens, and were made, 2,500 years ago when the Parthenon was built. And they were there for centuries, obviously, and some were damaged in an explosion when the Venetians shelled the Parthenon, and it was being used as a munition dump in about 1680. And some were looted, damaged, but on the whole, the frieze remained pretty intact until Lord Elgin came along in 1816. And at the time, Greece was not an independent nation. It was part of the Ottoman Empire. And through various legal documents, he, in theory, gained the right to remove some of the sculptures from the Parthenon and take them back to England. This is hotly disputed, but there is certainly some people who say they were legally acquired.
Yes, because everything does seem to hinge on whether they were either legally acquired or, in effect, stolen.
Not everything hinges on whether they were legally acquired, but certainly it's a big part of the argument. But anyway, they were eventually came back to Britain, I should say, really, because they originally were destined for Lord Elgin's estate, but he went bankrupt and sold them to the government stroke the British Museum. And they've been in the British Museum, I think, since about the 1840s. And that's where they've resided. But ever since Greece became an independent country, it has asked for them to be returned. And I support the return for a number of reasons. One is I think that the Parthenon frieze is a whole and indivisible work of art. It's effectively a procession of Athenians celebrating a feast day. And to have it split in two is akin, in my view, to splitting the Mona Lisa in two. It can't be appreciated unless it's seen as one complete whole. And secondly, I think that they were taken in extremely dubious circumstances. It's certainly the case, even if at the time they were legally acquired, they were sold by a government that was effectively occupying Greece, not the legitimate government of Greece. And third, regardless of that, I think that the time has come in the 21st century in a grown-up way to start returning some objects, only a few, that really resonate with the national identity of the nation from where they came. And the Parthenon sculptures, I think, fit into that category. There is obviously a counter-argument. They're legally owned. There's a counter-argument, which is slightly spurious, which is that more people see them at the British Museum than would see them in Athens. And there's a sort of compromise argument, which is, yes, the Parthenon sculptures had a big impact on the UK, which goes to your point about identity and culture. They effectively kicked off the sort of love affair with Hellenism that's influenced so much kind of Georgian architecture going forward. And so they do play an important part in our national psyche. Of that, there's no doubt at all.
That's the tricky thing, isn't it? Because so much of our culture is about cross-pollination, that it doesn't necessarily exist in a vacuum, but it has been influenced by things that ebb and flow across nation states. And And yet, if you're thinking about the psychology of a nation, people often turn to cultural matters to as part of the identity. I'm thinking now about Cool Britannia, when Tony Blair set about focusing on drawing attention to the soft power that we had at our disposal in terms of music, in terms of art, in terms of dance, that actually people in a nation feel good about themselves because of the creative things that come out of it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that it is the strongest argument, as it were, for the bathroom sculptures, weirdly, which is an argument that's never deployed, that they represent a particular part of our history. And as such, you could almost display them not as kind of ancient Greek sculptures representing ancient Greek civilization, but as a work of art of its time, of the early 19th century, that influenced so much classical architecture, if you like, in Britain. And as I say, kicked off this love affair with Hellenism. I mean, obviously classical architecture had been around and Georgian architecture had been around before the sculptures made it. But again, part of the reason Elgin wanted the sculptures was because of our love affair with ancient Greece. So there is that argument. And I think it's also the case, obviously, that different objects in our culture, you know, do represent our country. And Cool Britannia was one particular moment. In the Cameron government, we had the Great Campaign, which sort of rebranded Britain on the back of the Olympics as a kind of modern, forward-looking country. It didn't disabuse our, you know, we still used heritage as one of our biggest assets, but, you know, the Aston Martin, et cetera, as a kind of modern, forward-looking country. So people do take these objects. And of course, ironically, the Parthenon is the symbol for UNESCO, which is the UN's cultural organization. And clearly, the Parthenon sculptures and the Parthenon itself represent, however much you kind of muddy the waters about, you know, who are direct descendants or not of ancient Athenian civilization, represents for the Greeks their kind of national identity, their heritage, their lineage going back to millennia. And we surely can understand that in this country. We can think about Stonehenge, and we can think about whether it's Stonehenge or St. Paul's Cathedral, or the Cabinet War Rooms, iconic objects and buildings that represent our national identity.
Okay, well, let me muddy the waters for you personally then, because you've just mentioned your time in the Cameron government. And you, when you were culture minister for 6 years, you took a very different view of the Parthenon sculptures. So what changed your mind?
Well, I think when I was, I always say to people, I have two character traits that people who know me well identify. One is laziness and the other is cowardice. And on the lazy point, there's no doubt at all that one of the kind of uphill struggles, having gone from poacher to gamekeeper or the other way around, one of the uphill struggles of persuading people that the Parthenon sculpture should be returned is that there is a default position, and it is sort of embedded in our national character. It's a kind of island myth, if you like, which is, you know, Elgin saved the sculptures from being blown up. He kept them and cared for them, and the British Museum has kept and cared for them for 200 years. There's this sort of subliminal attack on the Greeks that somehow the Greeks can't look after these precious objects. And I kind of grew up with that myth, and I sort of believed it. And at the time, the head of the British Museum was a man called Neil McGregor, who's an incredibly persuasive advocate for keeping the marbles. And he kind of extended the argument to, you know, the British Museum is not the British Museum, it's a world museum. And many millions of people come and see these sculptures in a context where they can be compared to similar civilizations at a similar time. And this is a unique setting for them, and therefore they must stay. And I believed all that. And so that was point number one. And the second one was cowardice, in the sense that it doesn't behove an arts minister to take on one of the leading institutions, if not the leading cultural institution in the country, in a sort of head-to-head argument on something like this. It was an argument I probably would have lost, and it wouldn't have done me much good. And one has to pick one's battles. But I think part of the reason that changed my mind is I do think the whole mood and tone has changed about restitution, which, as I say, is this sort of grown-up attitude where people are prepared to say, look, you know, we are proud of our country and we're proud of our history, but no family and no country has a perfect and unblemished record, and we can be critical or critique our history without undermining whatever you like to call it, patriotism or love of our country. And also the countries who we may or may not have exploited in terms of getting their cultural artifacts are now kind of fully fledged independent countries who are perfectly capable of looking after their own heritage. And it's an incredibly patronizing attitude to say, well, you can't have it back because we're much better stewards of it. I'm not saying that we should denude our galleries and museums of every cultural object we have. Clearly, paintings that are sold on the open market are perfectly valid. And the British Museum is stuffed with ancient Greek artifacts, which you could easily exhibit in place of the sculptures. But there are a few iconic objects where it is worth having a debate whether they should be returned.
Well, as you say,
that's helped kind of shift my opinion. And the more you look at the Parthenon sculptures, for me, the arguments are pretty overwhelming.
And it's not just this as a topic, is it? Because this would arguably be the most perhaps high profile hot potato debate about whether galleries or museums should return items to the countries of origin. You're saying that it wouldn't necessarily have to happen across the board, because your phrase was denuding those galleries and museums. And also smaller galleries are not bound by the same restrictions, are they? Because some galleries have already started to give things back.
That's right. The Horniman Museum has returned some Benin bronzes. The V&A is bound by the rules, but has lent a sarcophagus back to the Egyptians, which is effectively on long-term loan and will probably never return. And people kind of chafe at the Benin bronzes, but there's no doubt at all that we looted those bronzes. There's no doubt at all that Nigeria can look after them. Fewer people may see them. I haven't kind of checked the shelves, but I'm sure we've still got a few Benin bronzes in the UK, particularly in London, if you're desperate to see some. And I think it's quite right and proper that perhaps, you know, we have a deal with the Nigerians where we can keep a few on display here. We have a large Nigerian diaspora in this country, for example. So, but I think it's a perfectly valid, and the sky has not fallen in, it's perfectly valid to say these came to the UK in the most dubious of circumstances, pretty heinous circumstances, and it's right they should go back to where they came from.
But how much of this do you think is a sort of cultural willy-waving? You described that idea of Neil McGregor, that he said it's not the British Museum, it's a world museum, that actually what we're really talking about here are cultural institutions who want to be able to say, we've got the biggest, we've got the best, come to us, as opposed to going to all those sort of smaller or middling countries. How much of that is going on then, instead of us having a genuine cultural impulse behind having these pieces on show?
That's a really interesting question, and I think you're absolutely spot on, because on the one hand, there is this trend towards restitution, towards righting wrongs and returning objects of preeminent significance to the countries where they came from. And that is actually clashing, interestingly, with a sort of competitive environment that's grown ever more competitive, because it was the British and the French and the Germans, to a certain extent, with their 19th century empires, who created the concept of this kind of universal museum. But as other regions kind of established themselves, particularly places like the Middle East, for example, and Southeast Asia and India, there is a movement there to create effectively world museums. And I obviously wouldn't call it willy-waving. I would call it an attempt to sort of create iconic cultural destinations. Because, and we'll probably talk about this later, they do see culture as part of the mix of establishing oneself as a global nation, if you like. And I think that it is interesting. I suspect that one of George Osborne's arguments, I saw it run up by a journalist in the Evening Standard, and I'm sure it came from him, is to say this is exactly the wrong moment for the British Museum to start returning objects, when we are now competing against these world museums. The Getty is a good example of one that was kind of recently established, if you like. These world museums with incredibly deep pockets, who are going to compete for tourists and compete to be these kind of global cultural centres.
I I'm thinking now of a gallery I went to in Abu Dhabi, the Louvre, where in effect somebody had just said, here's a large pot of money. We want one Velasquez, one Rembrandt, one Monet, one Manet. It's an amazing collection, but it's literally just one painting by arguably one particular painter, all slashed alongside each other with no real narrative to tell. The narrative is, this is what a load of money can buy you. And then a gallery and a museum that I went to in Addis Ababa, which in a way was talking about the cradle of civilization and the discoveries they had found in that country, which were really important historically, but were simply not being very well cared for in terms of, you know, the temperature control, for example, and the number of people that were allowed in at any one time. So is there an argument to say that actually in other countries, these objects can be not only looked after better, but they can be presented in such a way that they tell different stories, they ask important questions. Maybe some of those questions are around the difference between acquiring something legally and stealing it. Is that not part of the role, the function of some of these galleries in holding on to some of these objects?
Yeah, I think that is part of the argument, without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, I think the Louvre in Abu Dhabi is an interesting case in point. I mean, when I talk to people in the region, they are interested in creating cultural spaces that reflect their own culture rather than simply importing it. But to a certain extent, if you like, the Louvre was the first iteration of Abu Dhabi putting itself on the cultural map. It sees itself alongside Dubai as a sort of cultural hub. People go, you know, it's got huge airports. People travel through the region to get to other places. They want people to stay. They want businesses to come, and they understand the role of culture in attracting people to live and work in their cities. And they would also, I suspect, say in their defense that many of the people working in Abu Dhabi probably come from Europe. So in a sense, putting on display European objects is not a kind of, you know, like buying a yard of books to put on your shelf. But nevertheless, there is still a strong, I think, movement as sort of phase two to say we also want to properly reflect our own culture. And then it gets more complicated when you talk about contemporary art, which is kind of more of a global and contemporary phenomenon. In terms of looking after objects, I do think that's an interesting point. And one obviously risks being, again, patronizing and talking down to cities and countries who would like objects back, and you're saying to them, well, you can't have it because you can't look after it. But, you know, my solution to this in the UK, at least if I was the arts minister now, would be to put together a committee. We have a committee called the Reviewing Committee for the Export of Works of Art, which we ourselves set up 70 years ago to stop objects leaving our country because the Americans were buying so much. We decided that we could put an export ban on an object if we decided it was preeminent and part of our culture. And if a public institution could raise the money, we could force it to stay in the country and be given to that public institution or sold to that public institution. And that works really well. And I think you could have an independent committee. We had it for spoliation, which is the system set up to deal with art that had been looted during the Second World War by the Nazis from Jewish families. You could set up a committee that could decide whether an object, if there is a claim for an object, whether the claim was, you know, legitimate from another country, whether the object was of such eminence and importance to that country that it should, on balance, go back. And I could see as part of the criteria that you would say, and also, is there a building, a museum that is capable of looking after this object properly? Now, you obviously, that's fraught with risk, those kind of criteria, because you can end up saying, no, we don't think this object is important enough to your culture. Or you end up saying, we don't think your building is good enough to house this object. But it would at least provide some objective oversight. It needn't even be binding on the museum. It could simply be an advisory committee, and the V&A could say, we've received a claim, we're going to refer it to this committee, they're going to consider it, and we'll come back to you with our decision.
Lastly, what do you think could be being done now in Britain to, in a way, pull the nation together from a cultural point of view? There seems to be so much talk now about what divides us, about a disunited kingdom, really. Do you think there are common themes that, in a way, the government could be championing? Maybe Rishi Sunak's government, within the next 2 years before the next election, could be championing to make people think, feel, actually, yeah, we're a nation together, as opposed to just the sum of its parts.
Well, we have the Brexit Festival, which nobody really noticed, which wasn't actually celebrating Brexit. It was sort of a series of sort of happenings. But it's a really difficult question, because it's the sort of holy grail. And there are certain forces that really do work against that. I mean, the push for Scottish independence and Scottish identity is, to a certain extent, works again. You know, we've got to remember that Britain, you know, if you read Linda Colley's book, you know, Britain is a construct in many ways, and patriotism and the Union Jack in the 18th century was almost a conscious decision by the Westminster government to bind the four nations, if you like, together as one united kingdom. And that has been the problem Britain has faced, because, you know, Scotland does have it, so, you know, is a nation. Wales is a principality, Ulster is a province, but they all have their own different identities and traditions, versus the rise of English nationalism. So it's incredibly complicated. My solution, and it's not a solution, but the way I would play it, is I think we've got to rid ourselves of nostalgia. I think we've got to be proud of our history and our heritage and some of our great achievements. But I think the greatest strengths of this country lie in what we are today, which is things like the rule of law, our welfare state. I know that sounds a bit trite, but our welfare state, the fact that in theory, at least, you can educate your kids and have life-saving operations, regardless of your income, and that we're a sort of modern, high-tech nation. And I would be looking forward, because it's pretty rare. We forget how rare it is, actually, in this world. I would be looking forward and saying, this is the result of, you know, hundreds of years of history and evolution. And this is the country that we are, and that's why we're so excited. And we're a cosmopolitan country, we're a multicultural nation. We're a nation, particularly in London, where people can come from wherever they are in the world and feel kind of instantly at home. These are pretty unique qualities. I think this culture war thing that we've got ourselves into is kind of imported from America, and we make the great mistake of importing far too much from America. And it's a complete red herring and sort of bogus argument to be having these kind of woke culture wars that somehow people are trying to shame us about slavery or whatever. No one's trying to shame this country about slavery. We're just simply trying to say we have an interesting past, both good and bad, and both stories should be told when you engage with our history.
So maybe we could pin everything on Eurovision in Liverpool in a few months' time as a unifying event.
Eurovision is one of the biggest opportunities this country has had since the Olympics to bring us all together. That and ABBA Voyage.
You heard it here first, people. Get those tickets for those avatars. Ed Vasey, thank you very much indeed for being on my couch.
Thank you, Lucy.